Edna was getting up there in years and ultimately had to move into a nursing home. It was a big adjustment, but it was a good place with good people. On her first morning there, she was getting settled in. An attendant came into her room and wheeled her out into the day room where she could sit in the sun and be around other people. As she was sitting there, after a while, Edna began to lean very much to the right in her wheelchair. The attendant happened to notice that and rushed over and straightened her back up. "Sorry, Edna," he says, "but I don't want you to topple out of your wheelchair." Some time passes, and before long, the attendant notices now Edna's leaning way over to the left in her wheelchair. He rushes back over, straightens her up, winks at her, and says, "I got my eye on you. I'm not going to let you fall out of that chair." She smiles at him. Before long, she's leaning forward, about to come out of there. He rushes up, straightens her back up again. After a while, Edna's grandson stops by to visit, check out how Grandma's doing on her first day in the nursing home. He walks in, he says, "Hey, Grandma, how's it going? How are they treating you?" Edna says, "Well, pretty good. The food's okay, and the people are nice, but..." "What is it, Grandma?" her grandson says. "You can tell me. What is it?" "Well," Edna said, "it's just that they won't let me fart." The moral of that story, if there is one, the moral of the story is you can be completely involved in a situation, as that attendant was, see all the signs, and still miss what's really going on. I mean, no disrespect, but the biblical Christmas story is kind of like that, by which I mean there is so much going on in the biblical Christmas story, casual readers often miss the depth of the meaning. Key clues as to the significance and the meaning of the birth of Jesus Christ that can easily get glossed over. Let's fix that. Today we're going to go deep into the biblical Christmas story and see some things in it we've never seen before. Let's start with prayer. God, the birth of Jesus was a singular moment in human history. We want to understand fully what you want to teach us from that first Christmas. Open our eyes to see. Open our hearts to understand. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. Matteo was living a quiet life, working as an accountant in Honduras, until one day a powerful local gang approached him. They demanded money in exchange for protection. Matteo knew that the government was too weak to protect him from this gang. He also knew that if he refused them, he would become a target. They would make an example of him, maybe even kill him. Matteo didn't want to lose his life there in Honduras. It's all he'd ever known. His home, his career, his extended family, his beloved dog Bruno. So he paid them. Over time, their demands escalated. Before long, they were demanding that he give them sensitive financial information about his clients. That was a line he was unwilling to cross. "No," he told them. He came home one night, and they were there. Several gang members had invaded his home waiting for him. Again, they demanded the sensitive information about his clients. Again, he refused. They beat him mercifully. He says, "I thought I was going to die." Eventually, he cried out and said, okay, I want to help you. I'm going to help you." Then when they got distracted, he ran for it. With just the clothes on his back and the wallet in his pocket, barefoot, he runs out into the street, runs as far as he can. Several hours later, he ends up at the airport using his credit card. He buys a plane ticket. He says, as I was sitting in the plane, in my seat on the plane, waiting for it to take off, tears were streaming down my face because I realized I had now lost everything. My home, my career, my family, my beloved dog, everything was suddenly ripped away from me. He says, I prayed and said, God, you are all I have left. What's going to happen to me? When he landed at the airport in Houston, he walked up to a customs agent, showed his passport and his credit card, explained what had happened, and said, I'm requesting asylum. And then he held his breath and waited. Waited and hoped. Please don't send me back to a certain death. The story I just told you is true. Imagine if you were Mateo. If you came home later today to your house and gang members were there demanding that you cooperate with them, and if you knew your government was too weak to protect you from them, your only choices would be to become a part of them and betray your friends, family, and clients, or B, refuse and be killed, or C, flee your homeland, go to a foreign land, throw yourself on the mercy of strangers seeking asylum there. What would you do? And how would you feel? The story that I just told you, it's true. And sisters and brothers, it happens to hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people in the world today face that exact same decision. At the end of our first service today, Fernando, a new person in our congregation who's learning English, came up to me and using the, I think it's the Google translator, he said to me, that story that you told to me today, that happened to me. I said, Fernando, where'd you come from? He said, Honduras. It happens. Jeff, you may be thinking, wait a minute. It's Christmas time. Why are you telling us such a sad story at Christmas time? This is the season to be merry. For frivolity, it should be about hope and joy and peace and lights and glitter. Why are you telling us a story about desperate people fleeing their homeland instead of telling us the Christmas story? Actually, I am telling you the Christmas story. I just told you the Christmas story. Because you see, like Mateo, in essence, Mary, Joseph, and baby Jesus on that first Christmas had that exact same experience. Let me back up and explain what I'm talking about. You know the basic story, how by the first century AD and a little bit before that, the Romans had subjugated the Jewish people. There came a time when Caesar Augustus proclaimed a census, and that meant that Mary and Joseph would have to travel 90 miles from Nazareth to Bethlehem to their ancestral village. Mary was 9 months pregnant. That meant 5 days of walking or riding 20 miles a day on a donkey to reach Bethlehem. When she reached Bethlehem, her water broke and she began to go into labor. So they went to the inn and found that it was too full. Picture Joseph as he pleads with the innkeeper, sir, you don't understand my wife. She's pregnant. She's having a baby. We can't let her have a baby in the streets. Please, there must be some solution. Finally, the innkeeper relents and says, oh, all right, you can use the stable. At least it provided a roof over their head. And that's where Jesus was born. Because as Luke chapter 2, verse 7 tells us, there was no room for them in the inn. That phrase, that statement, it's what you would call an omen. An omen is a sign that foreshadows what is to come. On the one hand, I guess you could say it was fortuitous that Jesus was born in a barn, because later when he was a teenager and he would come home from worship and walk in the house and leave the front door of the house wide open, and his mother would say to him, Jesus, how many times do I have to tell you to close the door? Were you born in a barn or something? Jesus could smile and honestly say, well, yes, Mom, I was. But that's about the only advantage of being born in a barn. There's nothing romantic about being born in a barn surrounded by the stench of animals, unsanitary conditions on the floor, in the hay, and yet that is where Jesus Christ was born. It was an omen of what was to come. Because you see, now things were about to go from bad to worse for Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus. That brings us to Matthew chapter 2, to a little known part of the biblical Christmas story that is often ignored and neglected because it's just too dark, it's just too dreadful. It may be the most horrific story that is recorded in the Bible. Matthew chapter 2 tells us that the Romans appointed a regional king named Herod. And when Herod got word that a special child had supposedly been born in Bethlehem, who was destined to one day be a king of the Jews, he was not amused. Matthew chapter 2, verse 16, Herod was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under. Can you imagine? Mary and Joseph barely escaped with Jesus. Joseph had been warned. He was warned shortly before this happened. Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. So that just like Matteo, on that first Christmas, Mary and Joseph found themselves in a moment's notice, in the middle of the night, fleeing with just the clothes on their back and what they could carry. Imagine the terror as they raced to get out of Herod's jurisdiction as soon as possible to save the life of their child. Imagine what they were feeling in those moments as they traveled south into Egypt, and then arriving in Egypt, they were now refugees who were seeking asylum from strangers in a strange land. We don't know a lot about what happened to them there in Egypt, but it's not difficult to imagine. I picture in my mind's eye Joseph approaching a landlord seeking to rent a room and saying to him, look, listen, I don't have money, but I've got some frankincense and myrrh, and as soon as I can sell it, I promise I'll pay you in full. And in my mind's eye, I picture the landlord saying to Joseph, go back to where you came from. We don't need any Jews around here. In my mind's eye, I picture Joseph going to the owner of a carpenter shop and saying to him, look, I'm a carpenter, an experienced carpenter, and I've got a wife and a brand new baby, and we had to flee our homeland. We barely saved our lives, but I'm a good worker and an experienced carpenter, and I'll work for a low wage. Can I work here? And in my mind's eye, I picture that shop owner saying, okay, Joseph, I'll give you a try. Don't disappoint me. No, sir, I won't. And Joseph races back to Mary and says, I got a job. And Mary weeps for joy and looks down at her little baby and says, Jesus, I think we're going to make it now. I think it's going to be okay. Now, mind you, Jesus was probably so young that he had few memories of their experience in Egypt. But remember, as Jesus was growing up, these would have been the stories that mom and dad told around the dinner table, the formative stories that shaped the heart of Jesus. He would hear the stories of those who in Egypt greeted them as strangers in a strange land with harshness and rejection and prejudice and hatred. But he would also hear stories about the kindness of strangers and all that that meant to his mother and father and by extension to him, so that as a very young child, Jesus himself, hearing these stories, was developing a deep, visceral appreciation for what it means to be an outsider and what it means to have a heart for outsiders. Eventually, King Herod died, and Mary and Joseph were able to leave Egypt and come back to their village in Nazareth. But even there, Jesus found himself an outsider. For starters, he was a kid in Nazareth in northern Israel now, a little village in northern Israel, who had only known life and culture in Egypt, now suddenly transplanted to Nazareth. But even more than that, Jesus in Nazareth carried a stigma. Imagine the rumors. Imagine what people were saying. Hey, that's Mary and Joseph. Remember them? Remember, Mary became pregnant before she was married to Joseph. She said it was a miraculous conception. Yeah, right. And then conveniently, they had to go to Bethlehem to register for this. Well, they're back. See that kid over there? His name is Jesus. That's her bastard child. And in that time, in that culture, being a child born out of wedlock was a real stigma. So that even when Jesus was in Nazareth, he was the odd kid out. The one that didn't just quite fit. Do you know what it feels like not to fit? I do. I know it'll be kind of hard for you to imagine, but when I was a kid, I was kind of weird. Okay, when I was a kid, I was really weird. Here's a picture of me when I was a kid with my sisters and some of my cousins. Can you picture out which one of these in this picture is me? Somebody call out, which one am I in this picture? Upper left? No. Nice try. Bottom right. That's me. Notice the expression on my face. Here's a close-up of that expression. Like I said, when I was a kid, I was, well, a weird, strange child. My family lived way out in the countryside in Indiana. It was me and my two sisters, and so if we were going to play, we'd have to play together. That meant I'd have to play with my two sisters. My two sisters often liked to play dress-up with hand-me-down clothes that we had, and so I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to participate, too, and so there was this little pink pleated polka-dotted miniskirt that had an elastic band waist that I would pull on over my pants, and now I was dressed up with them, and we could all participate together. It made me feel like I belonged. Like I said, I was a strange child. I've told some of you before a story about a huge formative experience when I was a kid. I was about 7 years old, and my family was hosting a weenie roast out in the backyard. My aunt and uncle, some of my cousins were there. After we had dinner, we were all sitting in the lawn chairs around the fire and making conversation and laughing and talking. When somebody said something, I don't even remember now what it was that they said, but somebody said something that must have triggered my dad, who'd already had one too many beers, because all of a sudden, he blurted out belligerently, "We're not gonna have any sissies in this household." Without skipping a beat, my mom said, "Gordon, I thought we agreed not to talk about that." "Oh, all right," he said, undeterred. "But I'm telling you, we're not gonna have any sissies in this house." "Gordon," she said, and gave him a look that could kill. There was an awkward silence. Then somebody said something else, and the conversation went in a different direction. But I, 7 years old, I'm sitting there in my lawn chair and thinking, what just happened? I knew what had just happened. If Dad was worried about a sissy in our household and I was the only boy in the family, that meant he was talking about me. And apparently who I was, how I was such an issue that he and Mom had huge arguments about it and had to reach an agreement that they would never talk about this in public. So I'm sitting there as a 7-year-old and realizing for the first time, my dad doesn't like who I am. He's ashamed of me. He's embarrassed by me. I cannot begin to tell you the weight I felt on my soul. I waited long enough that no one would suspect and then said, "I'm tired. I'm going to go inside and go to bed." as I laid down in my bed, my heart was on fire. Who am I? What's going to happen to me? Where do I belong? What's wrong with me? I guess I'm defective. I know what it feels like not to fit. Many of you know what it feels like not to fit in many different ways. Jesus knows what it feels like not to fit. He was well acquainted. As the scriptures say, he was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. Jesus understands. But here's the thing. When you have those experiences of being an outsider, when it hits you hard, it does something good to your heart. It begins to shape within you a heart that cares passionately about others who are outsiders. Back in the 1950s, a little boy was riding his bicycle down a country road when he sees a handmade sign that says, "Free puppies available." So he walks up that long driveway to the farmhouse where the farmer's sitting on the front porch. He says to the farmer, "Hey, mister, I'd like to see those pups." So the farmer gives a whistle and a call, and before long, the mama dog's walking around the corner with several bouncing, playful puppies following behind her. The little boy sits down on the ground and plays with the puppies for a while, gets to know each of them. Then he picks up one of them, looks at the farmer, and says, "This is the one I want." The farmer says to him, "Oh, son, you don't want that one. Didn't you notice she has a bum leg? She'll never be able to keep up with you, run and play like you want her to." The little boy said, "No, sir, this is the one I want." And then he leaned over, the little boy did, and pulled up his pant leg far enough to reveal a steel brace. Polio had left its mark. The little boy looked that farmer in the eye and said to him, "This is the one I want. She'll need someone who understands." No one understands like Jesus. That is why I believe it is no accident. That is why I believe God allowed Jesus to know what it feels like to be born in a barn, allowed Jesus to know what it feels like to be part of a refugee family seeking asylum in a foreign and hostile land. That's why God allowed Jesus to know what it felt like to live in Nazareth and be stigmatized as that bastard child, because in the process, the heart of Jesus was being developed and shaped to prepare him to be everything that God had sent him here to be. And sure enough, when Jesus launched his public ministry again and again, everywhere we look in the ministry of Jesus, we see his heart shining through. We see the empathy that Jesus had for the woman who was accused of adultery. Remember, Jesus' mother had also been probably falsely accused of the same thing. So Jesus understood. He felt that deeply and came to the defense of that woman. We see the empathy of Jesus in how he responded to those who were religiously despised, the tax collectors and prostitutes and so-called sinners, and how Jesus responded to the spiritually superior scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. We see the heart of Jesus when he boldly challenged his own people to cease their racism against the Samaritans who lived among them. We see the heart of Jesus toward the poor who lived around him when he said, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And we see the heart of Jesus and how he responded to the sick and the disabled, to the man who had been born blind, to the woman who had been bleeding from her female organs for 18 years, and from the leper, the man with leprosy that approached him and pleaded for healing. That is one of my favorite gospel stories. You have to understand that in Jesus' time, to have leprosy would be akin to what it was like in the mid-1980s here in the United States to be a gay man with AIDS. Back in 1985, if you were a gay man with AIDS, you were untouchable. Stay away. People didn't even want you in your home. Don't use my toilet, please. I don't even want to touch you or breathe your air. People were desperately fearful, and that's how it was if you had leprosy. In ancient times, when you would be diagnosed with leprosy, the first thing would happen is you would be kicked out of your home. The city officials would see to that because you were believed to be desperately contagious. You'd be kicked out of your home and you'd be forced to live outside the gates of the city, maybe with a few other lepers who were going through the same thing. You'd have to beg to get food to live. And when someone would approach you, you would be required to call out at a safe distance, "Unclean! Unclean!" so that they would know, don't get close to this person. He's sick. He's contagious. We don't see much leprosy in our world today. Some of it still exists in small pockets. Leprosy in its advanced stages can greatly disfigure the body. Here's a picture of a man with advanced leprosy. If you're squeamish, close your eyes. I'll just show it for a second. This is what leprosy can do to somebody. Disfiguring them in terrible ways. For those who close your eyes, you can open them now. Imagine the stigma and the pain of that. Matthew chapter 8, verse 1 tells us that one day when Jesus came down from the mountain where he'd been praying, great crowds followed him, and there was a leper who came to him and knelt before him, presumably at a safe distance, saying, "Lord, if you choose, you can make me clean." Maybe that man was kneeling, 15 feet in front of Jesus. But Jesus didn't allow there to be distance between them. Because verse 3 tells us that Jesus approached the man, stretched out his hand, and touched him. The crowd would have gasped, "Jesus, don't touch him!" Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I do choose, be made clean." And immediately, his leprosy was cleansed. I wonder how long it had been since that man had last been touched by another human being. I wonder what it felt like when Jesus touched him. Like the song says, "He touched me and made me whole." Again and again and again in the ministry of Jesus, we see the huge heart that Jesus had for those who were outsiders, outcast, and pushed to the margins. But there was still one last shoe to drop for Jesus' life journey as an outsider. Because you see, lepers weren't the only people forced outside the gates of the city. That's where criminals were also executed. Nobody wanted all that blood and the gore in the city. So when Jesus was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted, they forced him to carry his cross through the streets of Jerusalem, out the gates of the city, to a hill called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And there they drove nails into his body and hung him up to die. So that Jesus' life had now come full circle. When he was born, there was no room for him. And now in his death, there was no room for him. His own people had shouted out, "Crucify him! We have no king but Caesar! We will not have this man rule over us! Away with him!" Jesus was an outsider. And we who would follow him are now called to walk in his footsteps. Think about what that means. Hebrews 13:12 puts it this way. Jesus suffered and died outside the city gates to make his people holy by means of his own blood. So now, let us go out to him, outside the camp, and bear the disgrace he bore. We who would follow Jesus are not meant to spend all our time in the city partying with the in crowd, We're meant to be the kind of people who will follow Jesus out the gates of the city to where the lepers live, to touch them, to open our hearts to them, to proclaim good news to them, to make room for those for whom there is no room. A couple weeks ago, David and I were on vacation Thanksgiving week in the Smoky Mountains, we had the time there to watch a movie that Pastor Tandy had recommended to us called The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Any of you seen that movie? Powerful movie. You should watch it if you haven't. The Eyes of Tammy Faye tells the story of Tammy Faye Baker and her husband Jim Baker. They were in the 1980s, by far the most popular TV evangelists. I mean, they were all, their show called the PTL Club, short for Praise the Lord Club, was all the rage on TV, but far and away the most viewed Christian or religious programming on television. Man, they were flying high back then. And by the way, as many of you know, eventually it all fell away in scandal. Jim Baker in particular was all about whatever it takes to get an audience. But Tammy Faye, though she had her flaws and her excesses, and of course you remember she wore all her heavy makeup and was quite flamboyant in who she was, but she was a little bit different. She had a real heart for people who were outcasts. Because you see, growing up, she was the child of a divorced mother who played the piano in a Pentecostal church. And so when her mother divorced and then remarried, in the eyes of the congregants, Tammy was her mother's bastard child, a child of sin. And her mother made Tammy stay home and not go to church, because Tammy's presence at church would be a painful reminder of her mother's sin in the eyes of the congregation. So at a very young age, Tammy learned the pain of being pushed aside. And so she had a real heart for outsiders. Jim would preach and do interviews, but Tammy would do interviews, she would sing, she would do puppets, and she would often cry. At the height of their ministry, shortly before it all came crashing down, she did something bold and audacious. She did a 25-minute live interview on their show with a man named Reverend Steve Peters. Steve Peters, this was in 1985, was a gay preacher with AIDS. The fact that she would talk on her show to millions of evangelical Christians, to a gay preacher with AIDS, was mind-blowing and very risky. Not just that, but she conducted the interview not as a cynical questioner, but she talked to him like he was her brother, like he was her brother in Christ, her spiritual equal. After seeing the movie, I went back and watched the actual original interview, which you can still find on YouTube if you want to watch it. It's worth watching. She starts off the interview with these words. She said, "Steve, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing this. It must take a lot of courage to do this." Steve was doing the interview by satellite from California. They were filming in South Carolina, so they were apart, but he was there by satellite. She then began to ask him lots of honest questions that set him up to knock down the negative stereotypes that so many conservative and evangelical Christians have about gay people and had about AIDS. At one point she said, "What was it like when you told your parents? How did they respond?" Steve said, "Well, my mother cried. But my father said, 'Steve, you're my son, and nothing will ever change that.'" Tammy Faye said, "Oh, thank God. Thank God for moms and dads who'll stand with a young person. It's very important," she said, looking into the camera, looking at her audience. "No matter what happens in their life, they're still your boy. They're still your girl." That's the way, she said, with Jesus. Jesus loves us through anything. Whoa. Later in the interview, she said, "Steve, this is an emotional interview for me. I want to put my arms around you. When I finally see you in person," she said, "I'm going to give you a big hug." She went on to tell how she and Jim had recently, before this interview, watched a documentary about a young man with AIDS, and the young man had told how his parents and his sister were now afraid to touch him. The interviewer asked the young man, "What is it that makes you most sad?" The young man, Tammy said, responded, "To think that I might never again have a hug." Tammy began to weep. She said, looking at her audience, "How sad that we Christians, who are called to be the salt of the earth and to love everyone, are afraid so much of aged patients that we'll not go up to them and put our arms around them and tell them that we care." She looked at Steve in his satellite image and said, "Steve, there are a lot of Christians here who love you and would not be afraid to put their arm around you." And her audience of conservative evangelical Christians applauded. You see what she was doing here? She was breaking glass. She was being a rebel. And boy, was there a backlash. The godfather of televangelists back then, Jerry Falwell, saw this and was infuriated and determined that the Bakers were dangerous and had to be stopped. I won't tell you the rest of the story, but let's just say Falwell then played a key role in bringing down the PTL club. They had to be stopped. Because you see, there are a lot of Christians in this world who are in the habit of blaming God for their prejudices. It happens all the time. One afternoon, Elizabeth Schmidt was having lunch with her granddaughter, Carrie, and Carrie wasn't eating her lunch. So Grandma said, "Carrie, why aren't you eating?" Carrie, 4 years old, said, "God told me not to." Grandma said, "Carrie, God wouldn't tell you not to eat your food." Carrie looked up at the ceiling, kind of frustrated, and said, "Well, maybe it was Moses." There are a whole lot of Christians in this world that are looking to Moses instead of Jesus and blaming their prejudices on God. Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus was breaking the glass. Jesus was radically inclusive. Jesus understood what it is to be an outsider, and he had a huge heart for those who are outsiders, which brings us all the way back to where we started with the biblical Christmas story. You know that after Jesus was born, angels appeared to shepherds announcing the birth of Jesus. And we hear that and we think, oh, what a sweet story. Oh, what a pastoral setting that must have been. Oh, that's just so quaint. And in so doing, we are missing a critically important clue in the biblical Christmas story. You see, in early Old Testament times, shepherds were held in high esteem. King David had been a shepherd, and King David wrote, "The Lord is my shepherd." But hundreds of years later, when Jesus was alive, the world had changed. Population had exploded. There were cities dotting the land everywhere, and farming had become the most common occupation. Farmers raising crops on fixed plots of land without, in that ancient world, fences around their crops. So by this time, nomadic shepherds who would come through with their flocks of sheep would trespass on farmers' property, and their sheep would trample the crops of farmers. And so over time, shepherds became known as trespassers and as thieves who would trample your crops, so that Joachim Jeremias, a New Testament scholar in his epic work, New Testament Theology, tells us that in the time of Jesus, the list of occupations that were commonly viewed as immoral in Jesus' culture included things like gamblers, usurers, tax collectors, and herdsmen. That's shepherds. Shepherds in Jesus' day were seen as sinners, immoral, suspect. Ah, now we see a whole new dimension to what was happening when right after Jesus' birth, the first thing God did was to send angels to the shepherds. Look again at the words that the angels spoke to the shepherds. Luke 2:10, they said, "Do not be afraid." They were afraid. They'd lived their lives being told, "You're evil, you're a sinner. If an angel of God appears to you, look out, it's probably judgment." "Don't be afraid," the angel says, "for behold, I'm bringing you," not somebody else, "good tidings of great joy for all people," not just some people. "To you, shepherds, is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign, an omen for you. You will find a child wrapped in bands of cloth and lying in a manger." It is no accident that the first thing God did after Jesus was born was to send angels to a specific group of people who were excluded and hated, and said, "Jesus is for you." We who follow Jesus should have that same heart. Let me close with this. I've gone on too long. I apologize, but I'll close with this. Do you know the history of the property that our church sits on? It's an omen. Because you see, back in the 1800s, our church property was part of a 400-acre farm owned by a man named Hiram Bacon, who was a devout Christian abolitionist. And this farm, this property upon which our church sits now, in the 1800s, was a station on the Underground Railroad. So that African Americans fleeing slavery in the South would make it to Cincinnati, and from Cincinnati they had to get to Indianapolis, so they ultimately get to Chicago and further north where it would be safer. And this property was a way station on the Underground Railroad. Picture escaped slaves arriving at this property and knowing it was safe space, a place of refuge where they would be nurtured, where they would be fed, where they could hide and renew themselves until they were ready to continue the journey. When I'm out walking my dogs during the week across this property, I find myself trying to imagine what it was like for someone to be hiding in the fence row out back and almost home to safety. This property was once part of the Underground Railroad. I think it is no accident that God chose to put this church on this property at this time. It's an omen. It's a sign of who we are supposed to be. Back in the day when this church was first founded, the early 1990s, before my time, before probably Duty was here, but none of the rest of us were here back then. And I don't mean to date her. She's younger than I am, but she was here back then. But we weren't. Back in the day when this church first started, people wouldn't put their last name in the church bulletin for fear that it might be leaked to someone else and they might lose their job or something worse. That she might be kicked out of the army or something worse. But people knew that this was safe space, because this church was founded as a church of refuge in the early 1990s for LGBTQ people who were fleeing persecution in other churches and knew that here they would be safe, and here they could find renewal, and here they could find liberty in Jesus Christ. That's who we were as a church. You might say we were an Underground Railroad church. And that's who we still are. And that's who we will always be. It's in our DNA. It's who we are. This is a church for shepherds and lepers and refugees and LGBTQ people and straight people who haven't fit in other churches because, like Tammy Faye, they believe churches should be places where all people are loved. This is a church where people who have been despised and rejected come and are welcome, and where people who've not been despised and rejected but feel called by Jesus to follow him outside the gates of the city and stand with those who have been despised and rejected, that's where they come. Good tidings of great joy for all people. You see, Christmas is not about the past. It's not just about the past. It's about now and who we're supposed to be now. When you allow Jesus to be born in your heart, you acquire the heart of Jesus. So in this season of Christmas, let's make room in our lives, in our hearts, in our church, in our social circles, in our politics. Let's make room for those who've been pushed aside. Let the miracle of Christmas continue in us.